For April 29th, 2024, it's the Overthinking It podcast, episode 826. Disappointingly, the show was excellent. Welcome to Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. The Overthinkers are your smart, funny friends from the internet, never happier than when we are looking at some cultural artifact, some film, television show, song, book, comic, any sort of the myriad forms of cultural production that the genius of humanity has produced for time immemorial, looking, marveling, beholding this enormous corpus of beautiful humanity, beautiful creation, looking at it dead in the eye and saying to ourselves, meh. I'm Matt Rather. I'm here with Pete Fenzel. Hello, Pete. How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
Meh. And Jordan Stokes. Jordan Stokes is also with us. Jordan, it's always great to have you on the podcast. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Fair to middling.
Meh. We're talking today about a culture piece in the New York Times. I think they have a slug for these things that's like critic's notebook or something like that. So when one of the critics of the New York Times has something to say, I have a thought. I've been gestating. Like John Milton apparently used to wake up blind. He was blind, and he would say to one of his daughters, "I need to be milked," which sounds so gross, but he meant he had verses of Paradise Lost in his head and he needed them to come and take dictation and write them down. He would lay in his bed and dictate poetry, and his whole household was, you know, oriented around serving him so that he could dictate his verse, and that's the dream, really. That's, I think, what we're all working for. The headline of this article, this critic's notebook by a television critic named James Poniewozik, I don't know how to pronounce James's last name, but Jimmy P. This article is headlined, "The Comfortable Problem of Mid-TV." Now, this is about a certain genre or a certain kind of quality spectrum of television, and mid is appropriating the Gen Z slang. And so I figured, like, what is the most mid way I could describe this article? And I think it was feeding it into a large language model and asking it to summarize it for me. The article discusses the rise of, quote, mid-TV, end quote, which refers to shows that are not great, but also not truly bad, occupying the middle ground. These shows are characterized by high production values but low ambitions, making them easy to watch. Wow, high production values but low ambitions. I'm sorry, that's a pretty good little parallelism from the ChatGPT summarizer there. That's, I'm just saying, that's it has failed at being mid, I think, in this one instance. These shows are characterized by high production values but low ambitions, making them easy to watch without requiring full attention. The author points out that while this type of TV may lack greatness, it fills a space in the current TV landscape. That is the mid description of the mid article about mid TV. And so when someone posted this in our Slack, Jordan, you were the first to hop on the bandwagon and talk about it. What is your toasty take on the comfortable problem of mid TV?
Yeah, here to serve in my duly appointed role as an internet echo chamber. The first thing that I did is say, sight unseen, without having read the article, I'm going to make a called shot, which is that it's not that culture is boring, it's that you are in your 40s. And that turned out to be, you know, upon reading it, he reminisced about a show that went off the air in 1977, so he's actually even older than that. But, like, I do think that part of what has to be going on here is that as people get older, certain things become less intense and vibrant just as experiences. And one of those is sort of your experience of popular culture. Like, I've seen this in myself, and I've seen it in other people that I know and care about and talk to. And like, it's not inevitable. It's not irreversible. You can find things captivating, but you have to put in much more effort. And I think that the temptation to say, oh, things were better when I was young, right? When I cared about art the way that a teenager cared about art, the art was so much better. And it's like, was it? Were you? Did that? You know, there was another thing that went around on social media recently where someone was like, man, I feel for kids today. Like, we had it so good. We had like Nirvana and Soundgarden and Stone Temple Pilots. And it's kind of like, yes, if you like guitar rock because you grew up when guitar rock was cool, you got to listen to a lot of guitar rock. But like, I guarantee you that the youths today are not sitting around being like, man, I wish we had some guitar rock. Because like, if they did want that, the music industry would provide it. Like, it's not, the culture is a hard thing to crack, but we've cracked that part of it. So, you know, I think that this is my take number one, is that there is a kind of like rose-tinted glasses of nostalgia, which is going to explain about 90 to 95% of this article. And I will say, like, to the article's credit, if you go in, like, he actually lists a whole bunch of really, really good stuff that he's watched on TV in the last couple of years. And he's kind of saying, like, why can't it all be like that? So that was my like take number one. And then on reading the article fully and getting to that sort of why can't it all be like that part of it, I have take number two, which is less, you know, man yelling at cloud and more maybe fodder for actual discussion, which is that, like, I put it to you that actually television has always been mid, and it's kind of necessarily mid. So, like, one thing that came up was The Wire as, like, the example of, we used to live in the era of peak TV, and The Wire was peak TV. And it's like, okay, so The Wire is 2002 to 2008, right? And this is something, Pete, I actually remember you doing this once with, like, the movies of the 80s, where you think about what the movies are that people think of as the quintessential 80s movies, and then look at, like, what did people actually go to the box office to see in the 80s? And it's, like, reams of trash. So, like, here are the top-rated television programs in the United States in 2002. Number one, Crime Scene Investigation. Number two, Friends. Well, it was like deep in Friends, right? Like 8 out of the 10 seasons of Friends, which is like, hoo boy. Joe Millionaire. ER, late season ER, right? American Idol, I think this is like the beginning of American Idol, so that's probably not mid yet, but like, boy, oh boy, will it become mid. Survivor, Everybody Loves Raymond, late season Law and Order, and Monday Night Football. That's what people were watching on TV in 2002, in the peak, in the golden years. But oh no, maybe, you know, let's, like, The Wire was just starting there. Maybe it needed to come and shake us out of our doldrums, right? Let's see what the top rated TV shows were in 2008, after The Wire is ending. Number one, American Idol. number one and two. So it's like Wednesday American Idol and then Tuesday American Idol are the top two rated programs. Then Dancing with the Stars, CSI again, NCIS, The Mentalist, Dancing with the Stars, Sunday Night Football, Desperate Housewives, like I think season three of Desperate Housewives, and Grey's Anatomy. And again, it's like not the first couple of seasons when it was actually like really a pretty compelling show. So like that is a mid-ass TV lineup, right? I think I said on Skype that like call that TV lineup Katharine Hepburn because its Atlantic accent is mid.
So yeah. So it was ever thus, right? Is your, I mean, so two things. One is that your first take was that correlation is not causation. When you say, man, the art today doesn't make me feel like I felt when I was a teenager. The problem is not the art. The problem is your feelings, right? That's take one. And then, take two is essentially it was ever thus.
Yeah, but like if you focus on the stuff that is aggressively middle brow and middle of the road and not bad enough to be interesting even, like there's always been a huge amount of that stuff and much of it is very popular with many, many people.
Interesting.
But I think that...
Oh, yep.
One question that I would ask is like, so like out of all of those titles, right, like which one is the middest? right? And why? Like, is there actually maybe anything to this idea of mid as an actual aesthetic, and can we point our fingers to it? But I don't know. That might be a pointless discussion.
Yeah. No. I think it is. I think it's interesting. I want to go to Pete first, though, because Pete, it was ever thus is this sort of argument that is the sort of argument that you make often in relationship to think pieces like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find it resonating with you now, or do you have still further insights on Jimmy P's take on mid TV?
Well, I love Jordan's question and want to get back to it, but I had two thoughts to layer on top of this if we're sort of piling up our core insights that we want to stand behind, or at least takes on it that we want to stand behind. The first is that it is interesting how he goes about picking shows.
Yeah.
I thought the most interesting part of the article was where he said, well, I watched this one show with Kerry Russell in it, and then I watched this other show with Kerry Russell in it, and it wasn't as good. And also, we love The Diplomat, so you know, you can take that for what it is. But like, yeah, I watched Atlanta, and then I watched Donald Glover's next project, and it wasn't as good. There's another "It Was Ever Thus" to be said about the fact that it's really hard as a creative person to strike lightning with two really brilliant hits in a row, right? Like, there's a lot that needs to go right, right? And also, if your method is like, well, the reason that these shows were impressive is because they had these people who are generally above television making them, and now they've gone on to make a second show that isn't as good, that might also suggest that the difference between the caliber of people is not as big as you might think. But then the other one was just like a really shocking absence of a serious consideration of bad TV, which I really love, and which I feel like the guys like this... the vibe I get from this guy is that he doesn't watch bad TV, and so he isn't really qualified to talk about it.
Don't
he mentions on this that Apple TV Plus is the HBO of mid, right? Because all of the shows that Apple TV Plus comes out with are these shows that, by his definition, have like impressive casts and high production values, but which don't seem that ambitious or ultimately that compelling or interesting. And I would remind him that when Apple TV Plus first came out, and this also might have to do with algorithmic recommendation, but the show that was always recommended to me in a giant graphic right on top of the screen every time I logged in to my Apple TV account was a show that I watched a lot of, but not all, which is, of course, A-list star, multiple Hollywood stars in it, huge production value. Bear McCreary himself did the music, right? Award winner Bear McCreary did the music for, of course, Jason Momoa's C, which is... And I've talked to you both about this, right? You've heard about me wax poetic about this show, right, Jordan? Or no?
I remember that you liked it a bunch.
Yeah, and it's a show about a future where nobody can see, and society is all blind people, and so they have like strings going through their villages so that they can find their houses, and it's like roving bands. It's actually quite tense, roving bands of people kind of trying not to run into each other or trying to run into each other for like much of the show. And then the story follows two kids who can see. And it's like, oh man, they have this superpower that everybody wants. And I've characterized it as both being like, there's a lot of talent that went into this show, and also just like zero faith that it's going to be any good at all. Right? It's just such trash. And it just feels like people kind of have contempt for them working on this show, but they put so much effort into it. And it's like so many of the things in it that don't matter are so well done, right? Like the way that the soundscape changes when the deaf people are walking around, and like how the sound design works, like especially if you're wearing headphones. And it's like no one's watching this. So I mean, I noticed on your list that Joe Millionaire was right up there on number three, and that made me chuckle because I watched Joe Millionaire. I went to weekly Joe Millionaire watch parties back in the day, right? Which are now a whole thing. Going to weekly reality show watch parties is like a big deal for a lot of reality shows. That show was bad. That was a bad show. And I think that if you're finding yourself stifled by mid, or like choked by it, or like comforted out of your mind by it, maybe you also need to watch some bad television to remind you of what it could be otherwise.
Yeah, start at the top of the Max app where it's, you know, recommending to you, you know, I don't know, like old Universal movies or something like that, right? Like old classic, you know, Howard Hawks films or something, whatever, or Warner's movies, I should say, you know, right? Like scroll down, because I assume Jimmy P. I assume that that's what the algorithm is recommending to you. Yeah. Scroll down through Bill Maher and John Oliver. Scroll down through, you know, the things. Scroll down until you cross the HBO Discovery dateline. Right? Scroll down and you will find plenty of bad television to watch, right? Like this is an article written by a person who did not watch The Golden Bachelor. You know, this is an article written by a person who did not watch Selling Sunset. You know, this is an article written by a person who has never seen an episode of Guy's Grocery Games. And on this podcast,
which is not mid, you can say a lot of things about it. This is a guy who does not have an opinion over the relative quality of different Property Brothers shows, which I don't know how much. I don't even know if we speak the same language.
Has no conception, no opinion about whether Zooey Deschanel took up with the correct Property Brother, and that is not a person. That is not a person who really ought to be, you know, I'm just saying the spectrum, what you think of as the spectrum of culture is actually continuous and hyperdimensional and, you know, going through realms completely unknown to you. That's what it seems like to me. But it's some of the things that you mention, like Jordan in your list, like Joe Millionaire or like kind of later NCIS or later CSI, right? I feel like the definition of mid here is not that I don't know. It's kind of not that it's bland. It's that it's moneyed and bland, right? It's that it's the, these sort of very high production value, like pretty, prestigious. I've heard the term recently, prestigeural on some entertainment podcasts that I listen to, right? Like it, so it's going to be like, you know, I don't know. It's going to be about to a certain extent, like Criminal Minds was a prestigious early on, right? It's going to be a kind of a gruesome murder of the week cop show with the FBI, but it's going to have Mandy Patinkin in it, right? So that's maybe a template for the sort of thing that we're talking about. You know, procedurals, right? Like it's a cop show, but the cop is, I don't know, pick your person, right? Like Robert Downey Jr. or something like that. Not that he would do something like that, but like it's a doctor show, but the doctor is Mark Ruffalo, you know. And then there's like a huge amount of production value and stuff like that, like procedural, so that the budget is high, the level of talent is very high, it's being kind of sold as a luxury product almost, and it's just artistically kind of bland, right? It's artistically unambitious. And the article quotes Bella Bajaria. I don't think it names her, but the Netflix executive Bella Bajaria, who at the time she was profiled in the New Yorker was the head of TV, but now actually has been like, I think is maybe chief content officer or something like that of Netflix, who describes the perfect Netflix show as a gourmet cheeseburger, right? Like the $34 gastropub cheeseburger that has like truffle bacon jam, on it, you know? And that's what does he bring up? Like artisanal American cheese. You know, someone is like really gone into the garage fermenting laboratory to recreate a gastro compliant version of Kraft Singles. You know, and that like it's so it's important, right? That it's not a Big Mac. You know, even though a Big Mac is certainly mid, right? But it's important that the burger cost $35 in order to be compliant with this guy's definition of mid. So it's kind of like, well, yeah, all those things that you're talking about, but that's network TV. You know, we have the streaming services now. We have all of this. We have all of this money. So everything should be better. So I think we have to I feel like we have to distinguish between like ladder CSI mid and, ladder CSI mid and sort of luxury mid, which is what this particular article about, because after all, it's in the New York Times, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if later friends might still qualify, because at that point they were also expensive.
Yeah.
You were kind of like seeing a bunch of money up there on the screen. But yeah, I mean, so like to start to defend the article a little bit, there is always this tension with highbrow culture as to whether it's actually good or whether it's just expensive, and whether the people who like it because they have refined taste, or because they like it because it's like affinity fraud, right? And like they see this being expensive and they think of themselves as fancy people, and therefore they like the thing that costs a lot of money. So like, you know, I think that is a real tension that's out there. What it puts me in mind of actually is like classical Hollywood cinema, right? Which is another thing that was marketed kind of as a luxury product and had very famous actors in it. And lots of it was largely sort of interchangeable and not all that impressive. I mean, for every Casablanca, right, there's like 12 other movies that are almost exactly that same movie, but no one would ever watch today. So, you know, like these things can happen. The question is whether it is happening. I don't know, how much time do you spend watching like Apple Plus, I guess they said, is like the prestige streaming network. Do you feel like this mid diagnosis applies to a lot of shows on there?
I mean, I don't watch the mid ones. I watch like the sci-fi stuff and Ted Lasso, which is not mid.
I think he said that Ted Lasso specifically was mid, didn't they?
He brought up Ted Lasso as no Ted Lasso. The argument Ted Lasso was brought up kind of ancillary to the argument that that Apple TV is sort of the new HBO, right? Or is the kind of the HBO of this particular genre? But he didn't cast aspersions on our mustachioed hero.
Okay. So I also do want to check in and suggest that we had this take too. We discussed this take, I believe it was in the second season of Stranger Things, was when we were basically like, okay, the golden age of television is over, right? Like where the show that everybody's talking about is less sort of tightly organized. It lacks a certain direction, right? There was a sense that the quality level of Stranger Things, or like what Stranger Things was trying to do from an ambition standpoint, was not on the level of the shows that had immediately preceded it in the sort of like show that everybody is talking about space. But Stranger Things is also super popular, which a lot of those other shows really weren't. Some of them were, but not all of them. Hey, can I answer that question that Jordan raised before of which show I think was the most mid?
Yeah.
Because I think this might add another angle to this.
No, you may.
I think if you're talking about 2008, then you're talking about post-Clooney ER. Which I would suggest is a different, almost a different show than Clooney era ER. And I would point out that ER ran right from. Did you guys watch a lot of ER?
Yeah,
I watched a lot of.
I watched a ton of ER. I watched from the beginning in reruns because they would run two or three of them on USA in the morning during a kind of underemployed period in my 20s. And so I am intimately familiar with the entire sweep of the ER-verse.
Right. So maybe you can confirm or deny like what I'm thinking about here. But one thing I would point out is the ER ran from 1994 to 2009.
Yep.
And it wasn't the only doctor show on TV during that time period, right? There are a lot of doctor shows on TV during that time period. You could probably
Chicago
list,
Hope with Mandy Patinkin.
I mean, that's the big one, right? With Chicago Hope. That was the one everybody watched. Mandy Patinkin is pretty much the king of television. That's what we've learned today, which should not surprise us. He has, in fact, raced us all to the top of the morning. But there, I hear all the time, like when I'm looking at, you know, reels and whatnot and people sharing clips on social media, I see clips all the time or looking at things in YouTube, still ton of interest in House, still ton of interest in Scrubs, never hear about ER. Nobody ever talks about ER. I maybe that's just me and the algorithm, but I feel like, but at the time, it was far and away the most popular of any of these shows by like a huge margin. Mm-hmm. And I think to an extent, what you see is this fact that it's been brought into existence and it's made this big hit. And it had, and it particularly, I mean, having Clooney on there, it has this particular cast dynamic, not just Clooney, but the way that everybody's relating to each other with Anthony Edwards on there too. And also with Eric LaSalle, right? Like people aren't on it for the whole time. And they come and go. And I got the sense that after a certain point, the show was about, it felt at the first, relationships among a particular set of people who were in a hospital setting, who had a particular sort of dynamic. But then over time, they changed the people that were in it, not just the actors, but the characters, and it had to change. And it became more of an extended soap opera-y kind of show where, like, okay, well, this season is about this, and it's different from the previous seasons, right? And this season is about that. And the thing that sort of followed it around was a certain standard of quality and popularity that it kind of had to live up to, but not particularly exceed. I mean, like, I don't think anyone would say that Angela Bassett was bad in ER, right? Like, nobody would say that, like, they got tired of Noah Wiley, like Mekhi Phifer was bad in it, right? Like, it's like an all-star cast, you know, people who were in ER over the years. But I mean, Matt, what would you describe as, like, was there a dawn going down today for ER where ER became mid and remained mid for a long time? Or do you think ER was, like, always outstanding? Or do you think it meshes up with, well, I mean, I won't make it a multiple choice question. I'll leave it open ended. Well, no, Jordan, if you want to talk about ER too, but that's the one I pick for most mid out of the group.
Sure. I mean, I think actually there are a lot of shows with long lives you can talk about, right? Like they get different personalities, right? Like that based on who comes on them. Another one, sorry, I'll come back to ER. Absolutely. But, Law and Order SVU is, definitely one. And you can kind of, it sort of depends on Mariska Hargitay's, kind of overriding emotional tone, you know, that she has, whether she's like really kind of gung ho and go get him, or whether she's kind of like disgusted and like, cynical about everything, or whether she's like hurt and very deeply feeling, right? Like there are these different eras in the show. There were eras where the shows like Criminal Minds were sort of pushing it to be more graphic in terms of what it showed, which is a little gruesome, to contemplate, but that was what was going on. There are ones where it's a little more, where it's a little more squeamish, or where it's a little more, copy, or a little more touchy feely, right? Like depending on that. So it has, I think if it goes on for, you know, as long as it does, it sort of has different modes, right? And it's interesting to think of them as sort of, I don't know, kind of overlapping lily pads or something like that, that the show, traverses as it, you know, crosses the pond or something. I don't know, the metaphor falls apart. But yeah, after the exit of that kind of that initial crew, which is like Eric LaSalle, Clooney, Julianna Margulies, Anthony Edwards, who, if I recall, spoiler alert for ER back in 1994, but I think they killed him off.
Yeah, Vic Mackey showed up in a crossover episode. He's like, "Where are the Salvadorans?" Then he went down in a hail of enemy gunfire. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, it's like, right, absolutely. It's and he saw him. He saw, oh God, what is his name? And the character is Mark Green. He saw Dr. Green there and he was like, "Nice bald head, bro." And then bam, shot him in the face.
No, he died of a brain tumor. He had cancer in the show. Yeah.
And that, but then, like, you know, I don't know, but then there's like later, there's the, like the Croatian guy who came on, who was on for a little while, and it had a different, had really a different vibe. The lead of Bend It Like Beckham showed up, for a good while and was on the show. Like I watched all of these because, as I said, I was underemployed in my 20s and probably like mildly depressed, like because I was under wasting my short, precious life. So I wasted it watching ER, and I saw all of these, things, but ER was so intensely procedural, right? There were always two axes that it was operating on. And one was the soap axis of the kind of the serialized, interactions between the characters. And the other was the activity axis of like whatever the, like, I don't know, there was a plane crash right outside the ER or something like that. And we're overwhelmed with emergency case, with trauma cases or something. I don't know. It was a mild plane crash. So everyone survived, but they're horribly mangled.
Harrison Ford just stumbles through the front door of the hospital. Like, got him. Yeah, validate parking in here. It's like a flaming prop plane behind him.
Exactly. So that's like, I mean, like the, so that is the thing that sort of what persisted with ER throughout was that technique, right? Like there weren't scenes at the bar in ER, right? They didn't, like, it wasn't, I don't know, like The Good Wife or something like that, or The Morning Show or something, where people would like go to a place with the intention of sitting down at a restaurant table and like having a scene, you know, having like a really consequential conversation. And so that technique of like, of the conversations all happened while people were doing something else, which is something that Law and Order does as well, but it's always like at the beginning of the episode when the two cops are interviewing the, like, the trash collector who's like walking along throwing the bags into the trash truck, and it's like, yeah, I saw Ron that night. We were outside the park. I remember because there was a whole couch on the curb, and I thought, who leaves a perfectly good couch on the curb? Anyway, that night I saw a dead body, and my girlfriend saw her first couch. And that's the same sort of two access. Like I propose that what happened is like the rest of TV caught up, because that sort of intense focus on procedure was a little bit groundbreaking at the outset in 1994, but like 10 years later, by like you quoted 2002, by 2002 it was sort of like other things had caught up to that other things had caught up to that technique, to that like procedure reveals character sort of thing. Anyway, way too much about ERP, but you asked, so you deserve what you got. Jordan, let's throw to you because you haven't spoken for a minute.
Yeah, I think that you may be onto something there with the catching on, because another thing, right, that this article seemed to say, it wasn't like quite a stated premise, but it was pretty heavily gone back to, is this idea that every mid-show can be traced back to like its glorious forebearer, the sort of the platonic idea of the show that it's trying to be, so that like, you know, whatever this thing is that Kerry Russell is on now is actually trying to be The Americans, which seems really questionable, but like...
It's The Diplomat! We love The Diplomat! On this show anyway.
It's not bad. It's a very different artistic project from The Americans, but like even in artistic ambition, some of the marriage stuff in that show is really interesting, and the relationship between those two people is interesting.
The Night Agent, that's for sure.
But I think so, like that example is just incorrect factually, right? But I do think there's something to be said for the idea that like you do have another one that they brought up was like Ozark, which they said is like, what if you took Breaking Bad and ran it through ChatGPT, you would get Ozark, was the line, right?
This is like the sick critical burn now. This is the new sick critical burn, right? Like, it sounds like X was redone by ChatGPT. Oh, so-and-so singer sounds like Taylor Swift was redone by the new Taylor Swift sounds like Taylor Swift was filtered through ChatGPT. I'm sorry, Jordan. Please continue.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a pretty hacky line, but, like the point being that very often a show that is going to be mid is looking at some more successful show and trying to like to copy the success without copying like whatever it was that made that show daring and original and special and new or whatever. So that like if you wanted to say that Friends is mid Seinfeld, like there's a truth to that. Not a complete truth, but there is a truth to that, I think. And if you wanted to say that like that NCIS is mid CSI, I feel like you would also be essentially correct. CSI itself being mid, I don't know, NYPD Blue. So it's interesting to think like of ER as being something that was at one point sort of groundbreaking and interesting. And then the later seasons of ER are sort of trying to catch that lightning in the bottle from the first season, but it, like it's no longer fresh and new. So it becomes mid as it becomes an imitator of its earlier self or something like that. I don't know if I really believe in this as a model of creativity. I feel like it emphasizes originality a little bit too much, but is that, I think, like, am I accurately describing something that the article seems to have on its mind there?
There's a strong and weak misreading. There's a kind of like a Harold Bloom thing going on here that the mid shows are weak misreadings, in some sense. Is that sort of a summary of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that that's what the article kind of wants us to think, which makes it interesting that like some of the things that they bring up, a show that the article very explicitly says is mid is Poker Face. I think Poker Face is great.
No, but yeah, it seems the show is wrong.
Yeah.
The article is incorrect.
The article
is wrong.
The show is wrong.
No, the show is right. So the show is right. If that show is wrong, I don't want to be right.
But it seems like the main critic didn't like go into a big critique of what made it mid. It just said like, oh, it's a Columbo retread. And that seems to be decisive, actually, that like, and you know, they're kind of right about that. It is very much trying to be Columbo in certain ways, although it also has other things on its mind. But I think that being that much a callback, a throwback, is maybe enough all on its own for this writer to make the show be mid. There was a line in the article that I didn't quite understand where it said like two of the most promising dramas this year are Shogun, which of course is based on a book, and there was a TV miniseries back in the day, and then a new version of The Talented Mr. Ripley. And that was the end of the sentence, and they didn't say like, and these things are mid because they are derivative. Or they didn't say, and actually these are two really good shows that I think you should watch. It was sort of like hard to parse which one of those they meant, actually, because they did say these are two of the best dramas this year. But then it did seem like kind of bringing up the fact that they are remakes or reboots or retreads or something is part of the complaint.
Yeah, this guy wants a certain amount of bold originality, it seems, like in his taste for what he's looking for. Right, like he wants, which might also be part of getting older. And the problem is like, well, you've seen so many things now, you know, the Breaking Bad felt more original. And that Breaking Bad's a bad example because it's like, well, what was the show that came out in like the 70s that was like Breaking Bad? I was like, I don't think there probably is one. But for some of them, you know that there's other shows that were like this that came out before, but this one feels new to you, right? Like, I was too young to watch The Godfather when it was new, so I watched The Sopranos. Obviously they're not exactly the same, right? But like, you know, it's The Sopranos does capitalize on things that have come before and the whole genre of stuff that have come before to a large degree in a way that is perhaps more exciting for younger people, I'm hypothesizing potentially. I think he seems to think that way. I also, by the way, I feel like Friends reads better if instead of seeing it as mid Seinfeld, you see it as mid Dream On. If you think of, because that's the show the creators of the show made before. Do you ever watch Dream On? Brian Benben playing.
Did you ever watch Herman's Head?
Yeah, we talked about it. We did a whole podcast about Herman's Head. Yeah. That Friends is secretly super weird, and they just cut out the super weird parts.
The character dynamics are more along the lines of Dream On, but in the people living in New York, dating women who are too beautiful to be dating them and living in apartments that are too large for them to be living in that sense, it's Seinfeld.
Yeah, it's not like, but yes, they also suffer from like twisted media soaked psychodrama that like warps all their relationships, like which I guess is sort of in Seinfeld, but is more in Friends, I guess. But also, I haven't watched Dream On in a long time. And it's probably going to be like, if I were to watch it again, it's probably so bad. It's probably like watching, going back and watching X-Men, the animated series, after watching X-Men 97 and being like, oh yeah, they didn't know how to make the same face two frames in a row. Like everything's all wibbly wobbly and terrible. It's a very different time. We didn't have that kind of technology.
So I think it's a combination of like this author wants bold originality, which is hard to find. And even when you think you've found it, it might not actually be original because maybe it's just like copying something from before you don't know. So that's one. It seems like they have very expensive tastes, like they only watch the shows that sort of look good. And therefore, the things that are bold and original trash are just like under their notice. Right. The good Property Brother show. And then, you know, it's kind of like what do you expect, right? If you're going to say that like the fact that something like I'm a Virgo, which is like a show that is, if nothing else, bold and original, right? Which came out like last year, and you're saying like, well, that happened, but you know, that doesn't really count. We're in the age of mid TV. Then I feel like this person is like they themselves are the sociological problem that they're trying to diagnose. And what they need is like a concierge who is going to only let them watch a slightly different set of TV shows. And then they will achieve true happiness.
Yeah. It is interesting that they don't talk about Squid Game, right? I don't think they did. Maybe I might have missed it if they did, but I don't think they mentioned Squid Game. I don't think they mentioned any shows made outside the United States, or at least outside the U.S. in like U.K. and the Commonwealth and whatnot. They don't talk about Squid Game. They don't talk about Physical 100 based on Squid Game, or any of the other Squid Game, the show, the Mr. Beast version of Squid Game.
that one episode of Guy's Grocery Games where the squid was really expensive, so it became like the Squid Game.
Yeah, exactly. So like, I mean, that there's some bad TV you could go down into if you go. But also, yeah, like part of what makes Shogun interesting is all of the Japanese actors that are involved in it. Right. That's part of what makes it different than the previous, interpretations of the work. But it's like, well, I mean, the big thing is, yeah, like there's TV that's being made outside the United States that's now available to you on streaming and you could watch it if you want. That would be a place to find things that are unfamiliar or new to you, or also things that are boldly original from different creators that you haven't seen before. But Kerry Russell's not going to be in it. Which I know
that's
is
true, yeah.
And I'm a big Kerry Russell fan. Now, again, I will say I've defended The Diplomat. It is fair to say that The Diplomat isn't on the level of ambition of The Americans, right? Like, it is to an extent a more mid show. I don't think it's bad. I like it a lot, but I don't want to defend it. But I do want to acknowledge there is some truth to the claim that it is not The Americans, because it isn't. Nothing is other than The Americans. But
I mean, especially as an actor, like you can't just choose to be on shows that are like groundbreaking and every TV critic's favorite show for the next 10 years. Like that's simply not a thing that's possible for someone to do. It seems weird to follow actors from show to show and expect the quality to be uniformly just like absolutely stellar.
This is the I'm thing curious, people so, think AI is going to do that it's not going to do, right? Which is like consistently get rid of the variability and the quality of projects. Right. Like, I don't want things to be predictable. I want them always to be the best.
So with Shogun, like I've not really been watching the Shogun thing. My wife is, so I walk past it a lot. And it certainly looks like a very expensive show. Would you guys describe it as a so that part
depends
of the midness?
Depends on the exchange rate. Yes.
Well, it was made in
the midness.
The exchange rate, what, with the Canadian dollar? It was made in Vancouver.
Yeah, Canadian dollar, you know, it fluctuates. It was made in Bitcoin.
I think for whatever reason, there are all these Scandinavian people involved in it or something. Like, this is a multi, this is a, like a big kind of multi, national production, you know, and I guess like it has to be because it's something that you want to, I don't know, either get like tax breaks for in a number of countries or exploit in a number of territories. And that's like, that's sort of that's the important thing but even this, like some of the thing that gives it creative interest, right, is economically determined as opposed to being how a, you know, lone genius typing in a Faraday cage of non-interference from all, you know, middlebrow culture, right, would choose to set up the thing. I'm sorry, Jordan, I've interrupted you again.
Well, the Japanese had opened their ports only to the Dutch, you see, so it all has to run through Holland. But so like that aspect of the midness, like that it be very expensive, is clearly there. Would you guys describe it as a middling show?
No, I mean now that it's done, it's one of the few I feel like that really stuck the landing. Pete, do you agree with me there?
Yeah, when the first episode, I was really thrilled by how middling it was. I think I talked about it on the podcast. Is like I was so relieved to find out the show was going to be trash because they like included like salacious, sexy scenes and violence, and like there's a prostitute in the first episode. I should say a sex worker in the first episode, and like somebody gets boiled alive, and it's like, oh yeah, like they're not going to make me work hard. And then by the end, no, that was pretty much just to get you to watch the show. The show is actually disappointingly, the show is excellent. But actually, no, the show is not disappointing. It's not disappointing by being excellent. It just has less. It has less salaciousness as you get deeper into the show, and in fact doesn't end up showing you. I mean, this is sort of spoilers, but like it's the book is the same. You don't actually get to see the battle at the end. They end it with like dialogue scenes, right? So like, which is the big, you would not be doing that if your job was to make mid trash. Like you would show the bat, you would do the third act Marvel Cinematic Universe thing where like you just like have a big horse battle at the end of the thing. But they don't do that.
Yeah, it's interesting because the CGI punching that the third act kind of escalation that culminates in a lot of CGI punching is generally kind of bloodless because Marvel movies are PG-13, you know, so you think it would be actually a little more lurid, like a little more salacious than that. It was, kind of more gory than a Marvel movie would be. But yeah, they don't show that. Actually, instead, like what gets really, I want to avoid spoilers a little bit, but there is an extended scene, in the last episode where one character talks at length about his plan. Yes. It's sort of like, here's what the story was all along. And that like, and the way that that's done, it's funny. It's like on a knife's edge because like tip one way or the other, and it would be either pathetic or else, I don't know, you know, kind of like overly formulaic or something like that. Like unsatisfying, but like it just balances, like it's very earned, this conversation and all of the satisfaction that you get, as a viewer in this particular scene is extremely earned. And then the way the scene ends is also extremely earned. And it goes back to the first episode where you saw someone boiled alive and the character who ordered him to be boiled alive was like, oh, he didn't say anything really profound right before he was, he expired from being boiled alive. And I wanted to like put this in my poetry book of people that I kill and like their last words and how it connects me with the ineffable. And then the courtesans show up and it's connected with the effable. But there are a number of things in the last episode that are like that, where you see where two characters have a sort of face to face, right? Like, and
can I break in for one second? I think that the level of abstraction that you were talking about is useful to no one. So let's just spoil it and say like who these characters are and what they're talking about.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'll go on. It's right before, is that okay with you, Pete?
I watched it. I'm fine with it. We've warned people.
And I'm fine to be spoiled. Go for it.
Okay. It's when, Yabushige, right, is condemned to death. And yes, he's got to be, and Toranaga has ordered that he's going to commit seppuku before sundown the next day. And so he asks Toranaga to second him to, which is, you know, if you watch the show, you learn that that means that someone stands over you with a big sword. And after you stab yourself with a dagger, in the gut, they cut your head off so that, you know, you expire quickly and you don't kind of linger suffering from, you know, having your bowels, all over your knees. And that's, so they have a long talk right before he does that, at where he's, where Torunaga just like, no, like, actually, I did this, I did that, I, you know, and just kind of lays out five or six, like, big plot points from the show. And he's like, yeah, no, the point was never that. I'm actually behind all of that. And I had to, like, manipulate these people. And Yabushige gets a great line, which is like, what does it feel like to bend the wind to your will? And then just the way that he kills himself, the way that he stabs himself, he does it kind of so quickly and with kind of a grin on his face. Almost like he's sort of satisfied with it. And as this student of death, right? And this is just a really good, it goes with the arc of the show, and it like lands the character in a place that is satisfying and also totally earned. There's also a kind of like a face to face, just kind of a look shared between Blackthorn and Mariko's husband, whose name completely escapes me.
Quintaro.
Right. Yes. And he's, when he comes to like pull the, come to pull they're working on a big manual labor task.
It's like Les Mis. They're pulling a boat into dock, except they're trying to pull a wrecked boat onto the beach with ropes. Right.
And so he shows up, and, Blackthorn looks at him. He looks at Blackthorn, and it's like, it's not that their animosity is gone. It's that they've kind of arrived at a state of detente or something like that, together. Then there's a thing where Blackthorn looks up at Torunaga, right? And he's standing like on a rock outcropping, and he looks down and sees Blackthorn, and like they sort of recognize each other. There are these moments, some small, some very extended, of recognition between characters. And that's the, that's the kind of the genius of the last thing, because they all feel really earned. Also, it's wonderful that, as part of this thing, Torunaga gave the Catholic Church, a plot of land in Edo, his city, which is going to become Tokyo, that they can build a Catholic church on. And it's right next to a brothel. he's promised the madam also a plot of land, and he puts it right next to them, just to put a finger in the eye of the Portuguese, which is great. But I don't know, Pete, like, did you have the sense of like, this is really sticking the landing that I had?
Yeah. To try to flesh it out, or make the commentary make more sense to more people. There were characters.
I have no interest in that. I have no interest in being comprehensible.
I know you want to confound and alienate the audience. The character of, say, Yabushige, who is a cynical samurai who is all in it for himself and who betrays people multiple times through the course of the story, and who is sort of notably impolite, right? And is like always sort of like, oh, this is all such a bother. Whereas everybody else in the show, other than the British guy who's hanging around, who's the fish out of water, is very, very strictly polite with each other. And so he starts out as kind of like a bit of comic relief. He's the kind of brutal guy. He's the guy that's associated with the insane violence and with the sex work. And you get the sense that he's going to be kind of the fun character. And then in the last episode, like the full scope of the betrayals that he has done and their consequences hits him. And he has like a psychotic break. Like he has like a nervous breakdown and becomes really, truly wretched. Right. He's like tearing his clothes off. He's like yelling at people to do things. And he's sort of like free associating with events in the past. Right. Like he's just like very distressed. And it's a level of confrontation with the reality, quote unquote, of what's been happening that you don't usually expect from characters like that. And so when at the end, he's the one who gets to hear the big speech, and it's his perspective that is sort of held up as the contrast to the perspective of the Shogun, there's a poetry to it, because part of the point is that the Shogun is more like him than anybody knows, because a big part of the story of the show has been the way that people put walls up both around their civilization and around themselves so that other people don't know their true thoughts, feelings, and intentions, because in a society like this, they can't. Like, it would be too risky. You're too constrained by your social relationships to let people know what you're really thinking and feeling. And so this kind of like cynical, you know, kind of like black hat, you know, he'd be a villain in a Western. You know, he'd be like Jack Palance in a Western, right? He's like Jack Palance from Shane, just sort of like sitting behind the bar, kind of going like this. And you know he's dangerous, but you kind of like that he's there. He's the one who gets to find the sort of secret knowledge, and it makes it all make more sense and feel more elevated than I think I would have expected from the show when it started. So like, that's one of the things, is like a show might start out mid and not stay mid. It might start out mid and then like be mid for a couple seasons and then become not mid, like Babylon 5.
I mean, hold on, because mid is an interesting thing here. By mid, you mean sort of lurid, right?
I guess in that sense, what I'm referring to, yeah, I guess I'm being a little bit imprecise there, because it's not mid. It's not what this guy's talking about. It's more about whether it's prestige TV or not. Well, it's more about whether it's really focused on its message or whether it's like taking breaks to give you entertainment, I guess. I don't know. What would you say to that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what are the pleasures, or like, what is the kind of the moment to moment experience of this going to be, right? And is it going to be like Game of Thrones style sex position, where it's like, all right, now here's how to like make the prostitutes do acro yoga while you have sex with them, you know? Yeah.
And that's, does he like, even mention Game of Thrones in this article?
No, it's not. Oh, yes, it does. He does, in order to compare it unfavorably with House of the Dragon.
Oh, sorry, to compare every sequel.
Yeah, House of the Dragon unfavorably with Game of Thrones. So that Game of Thrones took big swings and had like sublime moments and really execrable moments, but that House of the Dragon is just really complicated. Is really you know, I when I was in England for a month in 2012, which outside of in Oxford doing a Shakespeare thing and so I got to go into London and see a lot of theater, you know, standing in line for standby tickets and watching things. This was right after grad school. I loved it. And I saw the actor Simon Russell Beale, do, oh God, I forget what, Timon of Athens or something like that. Like some like lesser Shakespeare. And I went back and one of our professors was like, well, what did you think of it? I won't say who the professor was, because I don't want to, you know, get this person in trouble with British acting colleague. And I said, it was so numbingly competent. And it was so numbingly competent. And, it was, and that's like, and she understood exactly what I meant. It was like, yes, 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 absolutely. Like there are no moments of real excitement, in it. There are no moments of real stakes or real risk. It's just being done as this sort of like belletristic recitation that, you know, all right thinking people must, you know, I don't know, appreciate reverently. And, and this was a person who had worked with Simon Russell Beale, and this was a reasonably well-known British Shakespearean whom I was trash talking with. And so I think that actually if this article about mid were a little less mid, were a little less of a New York Times critic's notebook, it would be like, it would separate out from the kind of the flashes of brilliance. Now, I feel like the really lowbrow flashes of brilliance are up there with the really highbrow kind of like sublime flashes of brilliance, and would separate out from them the numbingly competent. almost like a horseshoe or a magnet shape, you know, where the continuum is bent, you know, so that the good ones are the really sublime, or just the really carnal and gross and lurid and you know, heads are get like you know, guts are spilling on the ground type of things, and the other side of the horseshoe, the U bendy part, the middle of the continuum, is the, you know, I don't know, the sort of middle brow belletristic stuff that is made more for appreciation than for you know, either delight or outrage, and that you know, I don't know, that is what the mid is, but I don't find this particular article quite coherent enough to make that case, which is the case that I would make if I were the writer of such a thing. Not that I would ever be.
I mean, it sounds to me like really all television just needs to be aspiring to the condition of Homer's Iliad, where like you do get to see the blood spilled on the ground and the guts flying everywhere. But then also there will be scenes where two men make eye contact over a distance, and that's just everything. And like if there's a big horse battle at the end, you don't show it.
Welcome to the second episode of my doctor show. We are just going to talk about all the cars in the parking lot. There's a Dodge Caliber. There's a Dodge Avenger. There's with no catalog of the ships jokes. Come on, guys.
No, it would be like, no, man, it would be like, you know, I don't know. It would be like the Lincoln Navigator had come from Westchester, and yes, it carried the, you know, it carried the Westchester Wolfingtons, right? And they, and Cyrus Wolfington, their patriarch, proud he, you know, navigating the navigator over the bumpy, you know, parts of the Henry Hudson Parkway. I don't know that I'm
Dr.
getting to
Lee came on the BQE in a Volvo CX30, which he drove aggressively enough to well underperform its EPA tested gas mileage, right? Is that sort of how we translate the Iliad?
Yeah,
everything should be the Odyssey, and the Iliad is a great guideline for literature. We should get on the horn with everybody to let them know that's what they should be doing, in case they haven't been doing that up until this point.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem with Shogun is that it doesn't begin with an invocation to the muse.
You joke, but I want to see this doctor show that begins with this like super sweaty invocation of all their cars.
Oh man, it's gonna be great.
They made that show. It's called American Psycho, except it's not cars, it's business cards, right? Like that's the, you know.
Fair enough.
All right, I think it's time to pull this catalog of ships into the harbor. Thanks very much for listening to us, Pete Jordan. Thanks for a hopefully not a mid podcast on a mid TV article. We'll be back with more Overthinking a Podcast next week. Until then, you can visit us on the web at overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.
The other mid jokes I was trying to think of is like that this TV lineup was written by Edgar Allan Poe once upon a midnight dreary.